I call questions without notice.
Who did what when? Who said what when?
Thank you for your point of order.
Every last tidbit of information for entertainment purposes.
Are there any questions?
Every last tidbit. That's right. That's what we're going to divulge tonight. In the house for question time this evening, we have David Hetherington. He's the executive director of Per Capita Think Tank. Hi, David.
G'day, Cassie. How are you?
Well, thanks. Tom Dusevic, editorials editor for the Australian newspaper. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Cassie.
And joining us from Melbourne is Bhakti Puvanantharan. How are you, Bhakti?
Well, thanks. Good evening to you guys.
And Bhakti, I should say, you're Deputy Arts Editor for The Age. So we have the two major houses of media represented today at the table. Now it's time for...
Order!
Round one.
Order!
Yes, it was all about praise this week for Prime Minister Tony Abbott. He was in a generous spirit and offered a number of people his praise. Question one for you, Bhakti Puvanantharan. Here he is yesterday with Neil Mitchell on Melbourne's 3AW. Who is he praising?
He is an Australian patriot.
An Australian patriot. Not someone he's usually so generous about.
Look, I was expecting this to be the clip about Emma Alberici.
Ah.
When you played that music, I kind of, my head went down that train,
right.
Who he also praised this week. So I'm not sure who the patriot is in question. They're going to have to pass.
All right. Well, there's a few scratching heads up here as well. Tom Dusevic, are you going to have a punt?
I'd say he was speaking about his political nemesis, Bill Shorten.
Indeed.
An Australian patriot. It's not the sort of language that we hear in Australia. You might hear that in America, but, you know, to be described in that way.
As a patriot.
It's a new turn.
Mm. Do you know, David Hetherington, why he bestowed this praise on Bill Shorten?
Mr. Abbott has chosen to include Mr. Shorten in his national security tent. Mr. Shorten's willingly joined that tent, it should be said, but he's decided that he won't criticise Labor on this particular issue, but in return for his magnanimity, he's asking Labor to come with him on the budget.
Oh, excellent answer. That's an 8 out of 10. Very few tents outside that big tent. You have to say. It's very, very strong bipartisan approach to whatever it is that we're calling this event. It's not a war, but, yeah. Very good. Now, on to question two, and this is for you, David. We might have had a slight clue, but here is Tony Abbott, once again, full of praise. Who's he talking about this time?
Good honour for having a go, and I think she spoke for our country last night.
Look, he's in a very generous mood this week, isn't he? Because he's picking out some of his, what do you call them, bête noire, and he's really, including them in the tent too. So he's talking about Emma Alberici at the ABC, an organisation he's want to throw stones at now and again. But he's giving a wrap for the interview on Late Line on Wednesday.
What did we think of that interview? Did you catch it at all, Tom?
I think it was one of those viral interviews the next day in the newsroom. I saw all sorts of people watching it, people who normally wouldn't be at watching Late Line. They might be at the pub or at a sort of very late night music gig. And it seemed to just capture everyone's imagination. It was, not only was it the face of that organisation sort of in bright lights, but it also gave us a sense of, it put into full view that kind of overly media-trained approach when a person just doesn't want to answer the question but wants to speak on their terms. And I think that from that it made an extremely memorable interview.
Bhakti Puvanantharan, what do you think? What did you make of it?
I think it was a great piece of theatre. I don't know that Well, I know that Emma was saying on Twitter yesterday she didn't think it was a good interview because she didn't get the answers that she wanted. But it was extremely watchable. I mean, you rarely see people kind of drop the curtain, as it were, and not accept the terms of the conversation like that. So, yeah, it was a very unique interview. And, I mean, it's really interesting that Tony Abbott did back her on that, considering Late Line is one of the shows that is allegedly on the chopping block at the ABC too.
On the RN Quiz, we're talking about an interview that was, I think, Thursday night on Late Line?
Wednesday night.
With one of the leaders of one of the more hardline groups in Australia. David Hetherington, your thoughts. What did you think? Some people have said that perhaps the opportunity, it was a loaded gun that, you know, was brought to the fight.
Look, as Bhakti mentioned, Emma Alberici's marked herself harshly for not getting her questions answered. And I think she said in particular that there was one question that she wanted to get out but didn't manage to, which was whether the interviewee found it appropriate or that that you would be interviewed by a woman on a senior, a prominent national current affairs show. It reminded me a touch of the Jeremy Paxmans. There's some famous interviews from Newsnight in the UK in the 90s and 2000s where Jeremy Paxman, as the host, was just ferocious in chasing the question and not taking an evasion for an answer. And I think famously he asked an opposition leader called Michael Howard 12 or 14 times the same question. I think Emma Alberici was, you know, clearly not going to be sideswiped and not going to be distracted from the answer she wanted to get. I don't think she got them all, but I think she did a pretty good job.
Mm. Well, a landmark interview nonetheless. Question three on the Question Time quiz. This one is for you, Tom the Deuce Deucevic, from the Australian's editorial board. Now, it was announced this week that Canberra was voted the most livable city in the country. When asked what he thought about that, Prime Minister Abbott tried to play it safe by praising just about every other capital city in the country as being equally lovely. But he left two out. Any ideas which ones they were?
Well, I reckon he would probably be thinking which ones have the least electoral impact. So I'd be thinking, maybe only one or two seats around Hobart and maybe only sort of one and a little bit around Darwin.
Oh, you're the Nate Silver of state politics, correct? Brilliant. In fact, territory politics as well. Yeah, a little bit harsh, perhaps. I mean, both of those places are beautiful. And we have many listeners there tonight. Hello, Darwin.
But do you remember Bill Shorten said when he was asked the same question? He kind of looked, you know, sort of even more...
Surely not disbelievingly.
Yeah, he looked a little bit more sort of uptight or sterile, that, you know, as he has been these days. And he said, you know, something along the lines of, I love Melbourne. Melbourne's the best. It's the only place to be. Because it's important for people in Melbourne to hear that sort of stuff. Because we're in Sydney and we've, you know, as David and I were just saying before, what a marvellous evening it is. We don't need to
come
be
on,
told.
Come on, Tom. All we right. all know Melbourne's the world's most livable city.
Right of reply to you, Bhakti.
Well, we do need a lot of validation here in Melbourne, but I would say that that makes us true Australians, because what is an Australian but an identity that needs constant validation?
Oh, so nicely put. Well done.
Come on, Team Australia.
It's RN Drive. I'm Cassie McCullough and it's our regular Friday Question Time quiz. Our guests are David Hetherington, Executive Director of Per Capita Think Tank, Tom Deucevic, Editorials Editor for The Australian, and Bhakti Puvanantharan, the Deputy Arts Editor for The Age. Time now.
Order! Round two.
Order!
Remember.
Well, the music might give you an idea that we are turning our mind back to the past, but only the past 7 days. Now, while the Prime Minister might have been full of praise, others were not so kind to him. Here was his reception at the NRL Grand Final.
The Prime Minister of Australia, the Honourable Tony Abbott, John Grant, IRLC Chairman, Kate McKinnon.
Apparently, it's not the only time an Australian Prime Minister has been booed at an event, a sporting event. Although I actually have never been at one. I've never seen it happen. It was an amazing moment, I think. Now, for you, David Hetherington, could it be explained this way? Which NRL team does the Prime Minister support?
Well, the Prime Minister, although a rugby man at heart, I think it should be noted, is a noted Silvertail supporter. So he's a Manly Warringah man through and through. He would have you know, have you believe.
Absolutely correct. That's right. And that was possibly the natural enemies of the Rabbitohs. So that was one of the suggestions why that the boo had been so strong.
I remember being on the last day of the 2010 election. Tony Abbott did this sort of crazy day where he did about sort of 18 hours straight, where he just went from one event to the next all through the night. And his last stop was Brookvale Oval, the home ground of Manly Warringah, with
spiritual
Bronwyn Bishop
land
in tow, with a big bag of cash. And it seemed to me that Manly aren't the
Brookie
sort
Oval
of
did well.
Club that needs cash. But there you go.
I don't know what you're implying there, Tom. Well, yes, the answer is Manly to that. But as I say, this isn't the only time that a Prime Minister has been booed at the footy. In fact, they've often had a rough trot. Question two for you, Bhakti Purvanetharan. Which Prime Minister snuck out of an AFL grand final at three-quarter time?
Because they were booed?
No, no.
Just because
he's just had a rough trot. He just left. He just left before the grand final was over.
Oh, you gave me a clue there. It wasn't Julia Gillard.
No.
look, I have no idea. I imagine it wasn't Bob Hawke. Maybe Paul Keating. That's my guess.
Actually, it was John Howard, the 2004 grand final, out the back door and back home, I suppose, on a plane to Sydney.
Well, I think that may have been. I don't want to be a real political nerd about this.
You can't hide the truth, Tom.
But it sounds that 2004 was an election year, and I remember that there was an election campaign. That was the famous campaign against Mark Latham. So perhaps he was trying to avoid meeting Mark at the end of the game,
the
you know, for the traditional handshake.
Well, you know, I wouldn't blame him. That's quite a reasonable response. All right, well, we'll leave it at that. And for the final question in this round, and this is for you, Tom Dusevic, which former Prime Minister and man of the people once declared that Steve Blocker Roach had kicked a lot of tries for Balmain?
This is a day of shame and infamy. I think this guy was into sort of clocks and classical music and the grand boulevards of Paris.
The arts end of Australia.
The arts end. He wasn't a Balmain
Darwin
boy.
Darwin from 40,000 feet.
I think so.
That's right.
Sorry, Darwin, listeners.
I'm sad to say that I think it was Paul Keating.
Yes, it was. Yeah. So how important do you think it is for our leaders to be seen as sports fans? David?
Well, I think we've got a rich tradition of prime ministers being booed at grand finals. You know, the Europeans in their soccer will have a kind of a row of monarchs and heads of state at the front of the grandstand. The Americans have the first pitch. The president will come out and do the first pitch of the baseball season. And in Australia, we boo prime ministers at major sporting events. But you know, once upon a time, it was part of the prime ministerial identity if it fitted. And you know, Hawke, I think, had this natural presence at major sporting events and carried it very easily. And then, you know, as Tom's just pointed out, Keating struggled to match that and, you know, famously palled up with Collingwood and talked about blockers kicking the tries.
Kicking some tries.
And then John Howard took it to an art form, right? So he was the sporting prime minister.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think Team Australia is a natural descendant of the level of sporting commitment that John Howard showed in those Wallabies trackies at 1 a.m.
Yeah, and you could never doubt his commitment to cricket. He was just mad.
Cricket in particular. Well, he spread the love.
Bhakti, do you think that a prime minister or political leaders can gain anything by being seen as promoters of the arts?
Oh, as promoters of the arts, I thought you were going to ask me about Julia Gillard's love of Geelong. But
oh well, yes, that's true. I mean,
well, you know, it's really interesting. Often, when in my job, I have to go to opening nights of the ballet and other kind of elite art forms, and you do often see politicians from both sides at events like that. And I think that a lot of them, you know, given that our political class comes from the upper middle class, that there's a natural affinity there. And I don't think it does any harm for both major parties, kind of, you know, a certain demographic of their voting base at all.
Mm. Mm. Tom Dusevic, do you think that it's best to be seen at the footy but go to the ballet?
Yeah, well, I think people sort of work you out if you're a fake on these sorts of things. You've got to be who you are. I reckon when it comes to the current Prime Minister, it's not often commented upon, but he's a man of great learning. He's, you know, very knowledgeable about literature. But I reckon that, you know, that on the high arts end of things, I reckon that there's probably a broader blind spot on this government, and I don't get a sense that the arts figure as prominently, the high arts in this thing. You know, Tony Abbott's a sort of Downton Abbey kind of guy. George Brandis is a sort of got a million books in his library kind of guy.
He's got a very big bookshelf.
Very big bookshelf. But I don't get the sense, and I think there are sort of moments in national life where there's been opportunities, I think, when people have passed, some of our great artists, and I don't think the sort of the right tone has been struck. Maybe that's just my own impression on that, but I think that's a, you know, it's certainly a weak spot that I notice from this government, certainly on the arts. On footy, they are rolled gold platinum. So.
Yeah, interesting.
Even though it's been shown, I think, that a quarter of us went to an art gallery in the last year. I think that was the latest Australia Council finding. You know, millions of us do engage with the arts, so it's strange that it's not seen as a political gain by this government, at least.
And public libraries are extraordinarily well attended. They're one of the highest government sort of infrastructures that have daily visits, along with post offices.
I mean, George Brandis's house, I'd imagine, would be one of the most visited libraries in Australia.
I just reckon an open day once a year.
Yeah. And, yeah.
there's a budget-saving opportunity, isn't there? I think it's, you know, one of the points worth making on the arts thing is, you know, there's some commentary around that the government's coming down hard on the Australia Council and saying, you know, you must take sponsorship from wherever it comes, and if that be tobacco or, you know, some of the more controversial sources,
casinos.
Yeah, because then, you know, don't come crying to us for money, because if you're being offered it privately, you should take it. So, you know, there's a particular kind of agenda going on with the arts there that in the context of a tight budget, makes the relationship pretty fraught.
Though I will say for Tony Abbott this week that he spoke up for artistic freedom in the West Australian Opera case. I'm not sure if you're all familiar with it, but basically West Australian Opera were forced to cancel a production of Carmen because of its depictions of smoking.
Mm-hmm.
It's set in a 19th century smoking factory, and a government health agency was the major sponsor and basically forced the hand of the opera company to cancel it.
Mm.
And to which Tony Abbott said that this was political correctness gone mad, and Colin Barnett quickly followed.
Mm.
It's an interesting theme, because opera companies can't turn on a pin, you know, or on a dime. They're big productions that have been brought in from around the world, and yeah, you can't just change it to make it suit whatever the prevailing. Yeah,
I can give you a scoop on Carmen, based on one of the letters we're running tomorrow from one of our sort of very erudite readers.
Drum roll.
And apparently Bizet, when he wrote Carmen, ran into some trouble in featuring the sort of main character as being in a brothel, and he had to change it to a cigar factory to make it a little bit more PC in those days.
Back to a brothel.
So these days, you know, no problem sitting something in a brothel, but if you have it in a cigar factory, no, you know.
Maybe it could be set in that, what was that, gentleman's club, the Melbourne club that George Brandis is a member of.
Yes, the Melbourne club, that's right.
Mm. Well, there you go. It's our mores changing and back again over the years. You're listening to RN. I'm Cassie McCullough. This is the Question Time quiz. With us, our esteemed panel includes David Hetherington, Executive Director of the Per Capita Think Tank, Tom Dusevic, Editorials Editor for The Australian, and Bhakti Puvanetharan from The Age.
Order! Round 3.
Order!
Man, I had a dreadful life, and
And yes, we're heading to Russia. We're turning our eyes to the, what is it, west north or east north, if you're looking really far. Either way, because it was Vladimir Putin's 62nd birthday this week. Well, he's in good shape, isn't he? Now, Bhakti, can you tell us where he went to celebrate the occasion?
I'm afraid I can't tell you where he went to celebrate the occasion. I do know, though, that he was gifted. It's funny that you say he's in good shape, that he was gifted a portrait of himself as Hercules, which I find to be an ideal birthday present if anyone wants to reinterpret me for my next birthday as a Roman god or goddess.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's true. And, in fact, you've anticipated one of the questions ahead of us, which is that, this one was going to be for Tom. Hercules was one of the – he was portrayed as Hercules in the 12 labours that Hercules underwent, famously slaying the – one of them was this multi-headed hydra thing that he was slaying, but instead of, being a monster, it was sanctions that he was slaying. So, he was slashing at the EU and the US and Canada.
But where did he go on his birthday?
Do you have any idea,
Look,
David?
I was just going to carry over from the earlier discussion about the opera and the ballet, perhaps, and suggest the Bolshoi. But it's a completely random guess.
No, he sent himself into exile in a way.
Try it out for a day.
So he must have gone to Siberia.
Yeah, that was a walk up, that one. That's right. He went into the wilds of Siberia, 300 to 400 kilometres from the nearest populated area. Why? Because he could, I guess. He was probably.
I reckon he went fly fishing or bear wrestling one of those manly shirtless
fishing.
Bareback riding. There you go.
Yes. Did he take the media with him to this remote location?
No, apparently not. It was a very private affair.
So he's just going for the serenity of the place, kind of like Bonnie Doon.
Yeah. But I think that the rest of Russia wasn't as.
Well, I think if he went sort of 300 kilometres away from anywhere else, then. He'd probably be getting ready to go to the G20 at Brisbane, wouldn't he?
Well, he will be appearing there. That's we know that now, don't we? All right. Well, we've dispatched questions one and two. Moving on to question three, which is back home, but still speaking of Russia, David Hetherington, which former Australian politician is this and what are they talking about?
And this Russian doll of nested factions is profoundly undemocratic.
Well, the irony is rich. I think it is Senator John Faulkner.
That's right.
And I think he is comparing Russian dolls to the nested factional pit that is the organisation of the Australian Labor Party.
You are correct. He was giving a speech, in fact, the inaugural Light on the Hill speech.
Which I was curious when I saw, because there's a Chifley lecture out at Bathurst.
I think it's a Light on the Hill Society or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
Well, this was at Revesby.
Yeah. So it wasn't at Bathurst.
No. It was an interesting speech. I don't know if you managed to catch much of it, but he was really sort of laying out a plan. Very, I thought, interesting ideas about social media use.
Well, John Faulkner's been making this argument pretty consistently for a while now about, Labor's need to reform its organisational leadership and move away from the factional model, which people within the Labor Party have criticised him for, because he is a product of that system. He's now an elder statesman who's kind of benefited from that, and he's saying to evolve and to thrive, over the next generation, Labor needs to have a different, more transparent, more democratic internal organisation. But it's a long, hard road for him. He's not getting much love.
Bhakti Purvanantharan, do you think that the Labor Party is in need of total reform, and is this a possible way forward?
Well, if the union commissioners showed us anything, it's that the unions aren't doing much for Labor's PR at the moment. And Faulkner's prescription, I think, is half the share of union seats at party conference, which is an extraordinary suggestion. It's a radical suggestion, I think. But I think it's a well-based one. And I think a lot of party members, branch members, would support him in that.
Mm. Tom Dusevic, total reform of the Labor Party. Is this the route to survival?
Well, it has to be. I mean, that's the only way that they can thrive. In the past, Labor's done it. In the post-Whitlam generation, they had to change the way, they had to change their ideological platform. They had to change the way they communicate with voters. They had to sort of go for a different kind of ethic. And they successfully managed that with some of the reformers like Keating, Hawke, Bill Hayden, John Button. So they've done it before. I'm not quite sure that the current crop are the ones that are going to get them there. You know, the sort of people who have thrived under union patronage and have come up through that Byzantine world of factions. People like Julia Gillard, for instance, you know, she always talked about reforming the Labor Party, but she was in the central seat there and never really nudged that along. Bill Shorten is a kind of another element of that who's very similar to a person that's emerged through that. More likely someone who's an outsider, like a Kevin Rudd, who actually did the biggest reform for many a year in that changing the way that Labor leaders are elected, half from the caucus and half by popular vote of the membership. So it's going to have to take someone like that or a really catastrophic defeat for Labor to change itself.
It does seem like change is happening around our political system rather than through it. Maybe the pace is what, that's the key issue. This has to happen faster. Now, I'm looking at the clock knowing that we've got to get to round four.
Order! Round four.
Order!
Okay, now, this is round four. Anyone can jump in. David Koshy Kosh made an enemy of a prominent Australian former politician over a certain joke. Who was the nemesis of Koshy?
Ding, ding, Jay Howard.
You got in there. Do we know why?
I believe that he made a remark about Jeanette Howard, an unsavoury remark.
One that we can't repeat here, yep.
That's right. And John Howard, in his loyalty to his wife, evidently, has never spoken to Koshy, and that is a 10-year dispute, I believe.
Even while being seated at the same dinner table, apparently.
And I understand refused to appear on Sunrise over that period, which for a mainline breakfast TV show is no small thing, losing a PM for
could
a
have
decade.
Been an own goal, considering what Kevin Rudd and Joe Hockey did with their careers. You're correct. You are correct. Now, question two, speaking of US presidents, who is this talking about former President George W. Bush?
And we went to the pub and we started drinking, sort of reasonable size mugs of beer. And I noticed that George was, sort of eyeing me off.
Maybe that's not quite entirely in context. Anyone know who that is? It relates to a very, very old incident that happened, it came out just before, 5 days before George W. Bush was elected, that he'd had this drink driving charge that came out of
Sharky.
A night.
It's Greg Norman.
Not quite. Anyone else? It's John Newcomb.
John Newcomb. That's right.
It was Greg Norman, I'm told, who had the same incident with Clinton. So you're on the right theme there. Yes.
They like our sportsmen.
He never spoke about it at the time. He went into hiding after the it
Who's
came
this,
out.
Who's this, Newcomb or GW?
And Newcomb. And he's only spoken about it for the first time this week. So there you go.
Well, lucky he went drinking with Newcomb and not, say, David Boone,
or Bob Hawke. Okay, well, look, just 10 seconds each to tell us what you think what headlines we're going to see next week. David Hetherington.
Look, I reckon Tony Abbott's going to keep up his fairly impressive track record of a backflip per week. We've had the right to be a bigot. We've had burkas. We've had 40 interviews a month. And I reckon he's going to stand up with Joe Hockey next week and say he's not going ahead with his paid parental leave scheme.
Okay. What about you, Bhakti?
Oh, I was treating this as a joke. I was going to say maybe next week he'll reinstate funding for the ABC and Ausco, given his newfound passion for both the arts and the media, the state media.
Well, possibly. What about you, Tom Dusevic?
Ebola hits federal budget.
Well, no, the Labor Party hit the federal budget. You know what Tony Abbott thinks about that.
Well, thank you all very much for being in question time. We're completely out of time. I'm going to give you all A pluses, plus, plus, plus. So thank you once again. David Hetherington, Executive Director of Per Capita Think Tank. Tom Dusevic, Editorials Director for The Australian. And Bhakti Puvanetheran from The Age. Thank you very much.
Is the father of your child the risk factor when it comes to your chances of developing diabetes in pregnancy? Family history is more than your genes. You can marry into it and perhaps double your risk as a result. And if you're a bloke, what influence does your wife's risk of diabetes have on you? Plus, food allergy in children. A researcher suggests there's no reason to panic. That's only a partly alarming health report with me, Norman Swan, available for podcasting from RN's website.